first thing I'd say is, Mr. President, you had in your hands a tool that would have permitted you to fundamentally alter the trade rules that govern commerce across the Pacific, that would have raised standards across a range of industries, and that was an arrow aimed straight at China to get it to raise its own standards. And you pulled us out of that. Now it's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You dropped the most important and effective tool that you had available to you.
This is Inside Asia. I'm Steve Stein, and that a moment ago on the line from Washington, D.C., was the voice of Nelson Cunningham, president and co-founder of the international advisory firm McClarty Associates. A former special advisor to President Clinton for Western Hemisphere Affairs and general counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee under Joe Biden, Nelson now advises multinationals with overseas growth and investment interests. 2 months ago, the U.S. president took an 11-day trip to Asia and visited five key countries. Nelson happened to be in the region around the same time, which gave him a unique vantage point on how Trump's visit played out and whether he accomplished what he set out to do. I gave Nelson a call once he was back in Washington, D.C. to find out how that visit and the Asia market in general is viewed from within the proverbial beltway. I started off by asking Nelson the big question. If after the trip, Trump had anything to show for it, any new initiatives, policy decisions, trade agreements, or diplomatic breakthroughs?
Well, I was over in the region. We were in Singapore. We were in Australia during much of the president's trip, and it gave us a fascinating perspective on his travels because both we had access to our sources back in Washington, but we also were hearing from those in the Asia-Pacific region directly about their reactions. Let me start by saying I think the president's trip was actually a very well-constructed trip. And my hat's off to those at the National Security Council who put it together. He stopped first in Japan. He stopped second in Korea. Third stop in China. Each of those were principally one-on-one visits. And then he went to the multilateral piece, going to APEC in Vietnam, and then going to the ASEAN and the East Asia summits. He packed a lot into one trip, and I have to say the overall shape of it was quite impressive.
You said well-constructed. You mean by virtue of his selection of countries and the relative issues that the U.S. shares with them or needs to deal with, or by virtue of just the caliber and quality of the engagement when he was here?
Let me talk about what he did in each country, and I think I have a mixed view on how he did in each country and how successful it was. In Japan, it was a very successful bilateral visit. Prime Minister Abe has understood from the very beginning how to build a relationship with President Trump. He was the first foreign leader that traveled to Trump Tower after the election and met with him. They played golf at Mar-a-Lago. They played golf again in Japan. He understands how to build a relationship with Trump. And so I think both sides will claim that it was a successful relationship. The second stop was Korea. Much more complex environment. You had a new president for Korea. Obviously, the tensions on the Korean Peninsula are as high as they've ever been. And on top of that, the president has been indicating he's ready to drop the CORUS, the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, at any moment. Mm-hmm. That has put tremendous pressure on the relationship with South Korea. I think both sides decided to downplay the tension. And the president's visit in South Korea was fairly standard for an American president.
Was this protocol, Nelson? Was this just, a lot of the pomp and circumstance and making the rounds and acknowledging Asia? Or did he have more of a hard-hitting agenda? I mean, he came in, as we're going to speak about in just a minute, about, deriding multilateral trade agreements and thinking bilateral is the way to go. But was this just really saying, I am the new president, I'm going to make myself seen, and we'll get to the tough stuff later? Or did he get anything done when he was out here?
Well, part of it is protocol. You know, an American president, first 2 years of an American president's time, and I worked in the Clinton White House, and so I have a perspective on how foreign trips are put together and how a president puts together his foreign policy agenda. There is pomp. You need to visit Korea. You need to visit Japan. You can't visit one without visiting the other. If you're going to go to China, you better go to Japan first because it's our closest ally in the region. So there's a certain protocol that goes into the visit. But it was designed to try to put to try to engage China. The first stop in Japan, second stop in Korea, the third stop was China. And the idea there was to engage the Chinese in assisting us on North Korea. And there is where I think the wheels began to fall off the president's trip. Mm. Because I think there it was all protocol, it was all pomp. Xi invited him to have dinner at the Forbidden Palace, the first foreign leader to have dinner at the Forbidden Palace, and that seemed to be the most important thing that President Trump took away from the visit, that he'd been treated better than any other foreign leader. Far from the U.S. putting pressure on China to support us on North Korea, I think the Chinese wound up being able to claim a foreign policy victory of their own.
Well, did he see that coming, or and how did he react to it?
A lot of observers saw it coming. We saw the president going to China. We saw the way that Xi had worked to build a personal relationship with President Trump at the Mar-a-Lago visit this past spring. We could see that Xi understands how to build a relationship and how to flatter President Trump, and he set about to do so, and he predicted it, and then we saw him do it. Whether the president understood that the whole point of the exercise was simply to make him feel important and therefore to set substance to the side, well, I can't speak to that.
Mm. It was, I think, in many ways, this is China's time, some would argue. And, you know, they weren't going to miss an opportunity to flex their muscle and let him know that, you know, Asia was their backyard, not his. Did that come through in those dialogues? And was there any impression, or was the Trump or his anyone with him left with the impression that China wasn't going to deal as in such a soft shoe manner anymore? They were going to exert their presence in the region?
Well, those of us who look at the Trump foreign policy toward Asia see that the strategy appears to be with China. Well, first, we'll get them to help us on North Korea. And then second, we'll drop the bomb on them with trade. It's awfully naive to think that the Chinese are going to fall into that trap of giving us what we want on North Korea and then suddenly finding themselves on the defensive on trade. So instead, the president got very little on North Korea from the Chinese, and he didn't even raise seriously the trade issues. So it turned into just an exercise of egos and of relationship building, with, I would argue, little progress made in the overall relationship.
Is it even reasonable, Nelson, in your view, to expect China to do much more than they've already done on North Korea? What would be your take? Because there's been a lot of emphasis placed on that, and it's a delicate situation, and obviously the Chinese don't want the Americans on their border. North Korea is a buffer and has been, and there's a relationship there. I mean, certainly, you know, the Trump administration and his advisors understand that, yes?
Yes, whether the president fully understands it, I don't know. He keeps on returning to the notion that with enough pressure, China could quote, fix the North Korea problem. That China, because of its long relationship with North Korea, could step in, because of its economic might, could step in and solve the North Korean situation. I think that shows a real misunderstanding of the overall dynamics in Northeast Asia. No other observers think that anything other than a multilateral approach are going to win when dealing with Korea. The Chinese have a deep, complicated relationship with North Korea, but they are simply not going to unilaterally take steps against North Korea that will fundamentally alter the dynamic without a multilateral approach in which they get assurances, the Chinese get assurances, from the Americans, the Japanese, and the Koreans about limitations on their behavior.
Fair enough. And before we talk about Vietnam and the Philippines and you know, wrapping up that North Asia circuit, I'd also want to better understand the perspectives of the multinational U.S. corporate country heads. If I'm correct in saying that your clients are primarily U.S. multinationals operating in those countries, is that correct?
Yes, most of the U.S. companies, but also European companies, Asian, Latin American, even African So it's a good mix of companies, but all big global trading companies.
So can you share with us some of the reactions during his trip to China, Japan, South Korea? Can you outline a few maybe lingering or primary concerns that they have based on his swing through some of his policy objectives?
Well, it's trite to say that business prides stability. You tell a businessman what the rules of the game are, what the rules of engagement are, and yeah, he or she will find a way to deal with them. And so volatility, risk, is something that business people shy against and that gets in the way of their ability to succeed. And I would argue that the Trump administration's very different view toward trade, very different view toward multilateral relationships, is injecting an extreme amount of volatility into what used to be fairly stable relationships. And this has caused business a lot of concern, a lot of worry, both in Washington and around the world.
Have there been negative effects? Have any U.S. corporations, for instance, been put off or rejected or had failed business arrangements because of this uncertainty or because of suspicions, for instance, around U.S. presence in these markets?
Well, I think there are two things that we have to keep our eye on here. One is, are companies holding back on investments? Are they waiting to decide where to build their factories? Are they holding off on infrastructure improvements because they're not certain where their factories are going to be if there's a trade war? I think clearly the answer is yes. We're hearing from our clients. They are slowing down business decisions, or they're making business decisions that are hedging, in a sense, trying to protect themselves against the shock of perhaps future trade wars. The second thing we have to keep our eye on, and that our companies are keeping their eye on, is at some point do they become victims of retaliation by foreign countries that are engaged in disputes with the United States? We've seen that before. We saw that during the Iraq War of 15 years ago, when countries in Latin America and Europe took aim against U.S. companies simply because of their nationality, and we might see that again.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, this kind of segues into the subject of trade, and trade is and remains the big concern. From day one, Trump denied support for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or the TPP, this 12-nation multilateral trade agreement that took years to construct and negotiate. You know, it held promise of reducing barriers to trade across member nations, and then he said, no, I'm not supporting that. I'm not getting behind that. I mean, clearly, that has to be a concern for U.S. corporations trying to do business in Asia, and even the remaining 11 nations look like they're going to move forward without the U.S. What are the implications there, and what would be your advice to the Trump administration at this stage?
Oh, U.S. companies are deeply concerned, and it's not just because they saw TPP rolled backward by the U.S., but it's because NAFTA is being negotiated. It's because the U.S.-Korea agreement is in the first stages of renegotiation. It's because the proposed transatlantic trade and investment partnership with the European Union is basically stuck in neutral. All of those reversals by the Trump administration are causing American business, multilateral business, great concern. They rely on these trade agreements to set the rules of the road and to lead to fair treatment for them in other countries and for them struggling to compete internationally. You change those rules, especially to take away the protections that they can get in other countries, and business suffers. And they're very concerned about that. But I must say they've been slow to the mark on expressing their concerns to the administration. We're still right in the middle of it.
Well, I guess that kind of goes back to my earlier questions around, you know, some of China, Japan, South Korea, obviously, and other markets in the region where, you know, Trump made a big deal about, listen, the better approach is bilateral. You know, I'll go and do some deals. We'll get the right terms and conditions. Forget this multilateral thing. But I don't see that there's much movement on that front. Am I missing something, or is he working in the back channels and trying to get some things done? And he's going to come out and surprise us in the next few weeks. Well, what's your view?
Well, the only bilateral agreements that we've got he is trying to reverse. So he's trying to re-engineer the U.S.-Korea agreement. He's taken the NAFTA agreement. Yes, it's three countries, but it's not 11 or 12 countries. He's trying to re-engineer that. And we're seeing no other countries stepping up to wish to negotiate directly with the U.S. Trump has said he'd like an agreement with Japan. Japan has no interest in an agreement with the U.S., nor have any of the smaller Asian players stepped forward. And why would they? They had a very well-constructed, multilateral, modernized trade agreement in TPP, and they can't help but feel that any sort of arrangement with the U.S. on a bilateral basis is going to be more complex, more difficult, and frankly, promote less trade on a global scale.
I'm Steve Stein, and my guest is Nelson Cunningham, president and co-founder of the international advisory firm McClarty Associates. We've been talking about Trump, Asia, and the negative impact this U.S. president has had on trade. Turning away from trade talks, however flawed, is a strange way to do things, particularly for a Republican president. Historically, trade has been a top Republican priority. That's my next question to Nelson. How Trump's decision to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and renegotiate NAFTA sits with his own party? Is it raising hackles? Are there members of his administration trying to guide him in a different direction? Or has trade, in Asia for that matter, been largely sidelined with other interests like tax reform and immigration?
It's part of an internal struggle within the Republican Party right now. I'm of the other party, but I work closely with Republicans. My firm is very bipartisan. Many of our clients are Republican. We work closely with former Republican officials. And I would say that almost all of them are deeply concerned by the president's approach on trade. The president's protectionist, anti-multilateral, trade-skeptical positions still do not fit comfortably in today's Republican Party, at least in Washington. So you have Washington Republicans scratching their heads and trying to figure out what the path forward is going to be on trade within their party. And frankly, I'm not sure I can tell you what it is.
Well, it's deeply concerning. And I think, given our work with clients in this part of the world, there is absolutely a blanket concern among everybody that nothing is coming out of Washington right now. And they're not really sure how to make their decisions. You alluded to it. And I think that's correct. We see lots of activity coming out of Europe, obviously a massive move by China to go global. Yet the U.S. just doesn't seem to be understanding the implications here. So, but speaking of China, I'd also like to get your perspective because we're so imbued with this out in Asia Pacific. China is, frontline headline news every single day. But how is it perceived in the U.S.? I'd like to get your view. What's the prevailing thoughts about China? I mean, is it friend or foe? Is it a threatening factor? Do Americans feel like China's rapid growth and expansion is something to be concerned about?
Well, I think it's certainly fair to say that there's wariness here in the United States. One of the themes of President Trump's campaign that clearly helped him catch fire, especially in the Midwestern states, that helped him secure his victory, was his anti-China, his really quite expressive anti-China rhetoric. And that continues to resonate with his base. It continues to resonate here in Washington with many. Those who are more sophisticated members of China are also wary because they've seen China's moves in the South China Sea, One Belt, One Road, the AIIB, all their moves by China to step out strongly on the world stage. And those in the U.S. who follow this are wary and are watching extremely closely.
What would you tell or say to Donald Trump? What advice might you offer him if you were given 5 minutes in his company, vis-a-vis Asia?
Yeah, vis-a-vis Asia, and I would say China in particular. The first thing I'd say is, Mr. President, you had in your hand the tool that would have permitted you to fundamentally alter the trade rules that governed commerce across the Pacific, that would have raised standards across a range of industries, and that was an arrow aimed straight at China to get it to raise its own standards. And you pulled us out of that, and that was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You dropped the most important and effective tool that you had available to you. Your strategy of trying to negotiate bilaterally with the Chinese on these important issues and to tackle North Korea first and trade second has not won benefits for the U.S. to date, and it leaves the risk out there of a trade war or perhaps worse in the South China Sea. Mr. President, fall back on your traditional allies and relationships. Fall back on the multilateral relationships in ASEAN, in APEC, that have, with Japan, with Korea, that have been the strength of the U.S. in the region. Don't upend those.
You know, Nelson, at one point, we thought with the Paris Climate Change Agreement, there were individuals within his administration which were almost persuading him to rethink his membership. And his participation. And there was some hope for a while that maybe he would, but then ultimately he turned his back on it. And obviously that hasn't, the rest of the world is moving forward again. Is there anybody inside the administration who sees this as a serious issue and could persuade him along the lines of what you're suggesting? Or is, again, has he made up his mind that he's moving on and, you know, when he gets around to it, bilaterals is the way to go?
Well, there are clearly voices in his administration that take a more expansionist, internationalist view. I've heard Secretary Mattis, the defense secretary, speak in an off-the-record context, and I have to say I was very impressed with the breadth of his view and the breadth of his notion of American power, which went far beyond military and included multilateral organizations, even including things like the International Monetary Fund. Secretary Tillerson has recently given some speeches to show a sophisticated understanding of issues on the Korean Peninsula with China, with India. But those, and there may be people within the White House that also share those views. But I think what we've seen over and over and over again is that when President Trump has his back against the wall on a difficult issue, he invariably goes the way his base would want him to go. So on climate change, yes, we understand there were deep discussions in the White House about it. And what did he do? He went to climate change. He went to pull us out of a treaty. On NAFTA, on the U.S.-Korea, there have been deep discussions about what direction to take. And in each one, he has gone with his base. That seems to be his fallback.
Well, it is a reminder on how quickly things can unfold and reverse themselves. I think you make an excellent point. You know, we think that institutions will prevail and it'll take years and years to unfold them. But, you know, this president has certainly shown that you can reverse things pretty quickly. And it may not be in terms of just physically changing things, but just undermining confidence. And that in and of itself can be a predictor for what follows. So, yeah.
This presidency. You can see this is part of a global trend. The invasion of Crimea, the return of a new Cold War in Europe, a European Union that's not expanding, but is instead contracting. The tensions we've talked about in the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, the increasing tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia. You look around the world and regional and national tensions are rising. I would argue that President Trump is a symptom of that. He's also an accelerant, but he's not the only symptom, not the only example of this. If you look around the world is simply different than you thought it would be.
Well, you're right. I mean, authoritarianism is creeping in and democracy is out of fashion in many places around the world. And I guess if there was ever a time for enlightened leadership and guidance, you know, at a global level, this would be it. And I suspect we can only hope, Nelson. What do you think?
We can only hope, and 2020 is, a short 3 years away.
Well, listen, I thank you so much for taking time out. I know you've got a big day in front of you, and it's getting late here in Asia. I thank you so much for your time, and when next in Asia, let's find time face-to-face.
I would enjoy that, and Steve, if you make your way to Washington, I'll give you some shelter.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Nelson.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Nelson Cunningham, president and co-founder of the international advisory firm McClarty Associates. At the end of each episode, we like to leave our listeners with a few thoughts. There's no other way to say this. What is Trump thinking? And what are we to make of his corrosive position on trade with Asia? First, as Cunningham points out, we shouldn't be surprised. When faced with a difficult decision, Trump acts in accordance with his isolationist attitudes that cater to the fears and concerns of his political base. The Chinese and Mexicans are stealing our jobs and producing low-cost, low-quality goods from overseas, or so he would have you think. It takes a businessman, he argues, to negotiate a better deal for the American people. It's for this reason that any trade deal crafted by a politician, which is to say all of them, is flawed and favors the foreign devil. Trump's constituency has been left believing that any multilateral trade agreement belongs on the junk heap just because it supposedly hurts America's ability to negotiate its own interests. Trump's obsession with bilateral trade makes no sense to economists, but neither does Trump's trade deficit scorecard. Trade deficits are complicated and not a sign of who's winning or losing. Unfortunately, this is the way the current U.S. president has cast the trade issue in the minds of the voters. And while the U.S. business community waits, the world moves on. Other nations aren't resting on their laurels. Scores of new bilateral and multilateral trade agreements are now under active negotiation. Trade opportunities, once a shoo-in for American companies, are now fading, with countries like China now favoring Australian beef over American, European wine over American, Brazilian pork over American, and that's just agriculture. High-end manufacturers of industrial and consumer products in Asia and Europe are striking new deals everywhere, and particularly with China, the very country that Trump sees as the leading threat to U.S. economic interests. It's a deeply ironic twist, and it points out just how out of sync the U.S. president is with the principles and levers of global trade. U.S. companies with an international presence are unhappy about this, but interestingly, they aren't all that vocal about it either. No one, so it seems, wants to risk upsetting or challenging members of the Trump administration who aren't beyond calling out naysayers and attempting to publicly humiliate CEOs who don't play along. What's the price to be paid? While the North American Free Trade Agreement, otherwise known as NAFTA, has so far staved off a threatened Trump renegotiation, if he does go after it, the U.S. is at risk of losing a valuable cross-border trade ally. Forget the thousands of lost jobs and billions in lost trade income that would follow. The biggest result would be a consolidation of China's global position as the lowest cost and most advanced manufacturing center on Earth. If ever there was a president who professed to contain China but acted to empower the country, Trump is it. As always, thanks for listening. For more on economic, social, and technology trends in Asia, visit us at www.insideasiapodcast.com. Listen to my earlier interviews on trade with Jim McGregor, Steve Okun, and Deb Elms. Download any of our 40 episodes and sign up for our brand spanking new newsletter. Until next week, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.